This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Prisons in the U.S. are booming. We incarcerate a greater percentage of our population than any other nation in the world. And a lot of those inmates are growing older and sicker behind bars.
The harsh reality of it is that a lot of us are going to die in here. For me personally, I don't want to be alone. I don't think any of us do.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about a program where prison inmates are being taught to care for their own. Then we'll hear about a special day in India set aside to celebrate teachers, find out about the long road back from a traumatic brain injury, and spend an academic minute learning about medical devices that are as smooth as silk. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Here in the U.S., we put more of our people away in prisons and keep them there longer than any other country in the world. And a lot of these aging people are dying behind bars every year. At the Maine State Prison, inmates are being taught skills to care for their sick and elderly prison population. Colleen Vasu has the story from Warren, Maine.
Every Wednesday morning at the Maine State Prison, 14 inmates take their seats in a cold white classroom. The men are dressed in identical gray sweatsuits. They wait patiently at their desks for their teacher to arrive. Most of them are serving long sentences for incredibly violent crimes. One is in for 70 years. He beat a woman to death with a frying pan.
What is one thing you think you've learned about yourself? Doesn't have to be a full sentence, just one thing you've learned about yourself, if anything, since this program started.
I think for me, Candace, is I haven't let the situation I'm in take the love I have within my heart to give to others.
Sometimes these men, the first time they saw anybody die might have been when they were the reason that this person died.
That's Candace Powell, executive director of the Maine Hospice Council. Candace is teaching these men to be hospice volunteers at the state prison. They're learning how to make inmates feel comfortable and safe during the final moments of their life.
My dad, they visit every week, and he told me his dad never in his life told him he loved him, and now he regrets it. Mm-hmm. But he said because his dad never told him he loved him, he just had resentment for him. Mm-hmm. So I agree. You got to tell people you love them every day. Mm-hmm. You never know when you're going to get that chance.
Mm-hmm. I love you, Wes.
Thank you.
I mean, the discussion is so rich and so reflective and so insightful, it never ceases to amaze me.
Perhaps the program's most profound influence hasn't been on the patients, but on the inmate volunteers. They're learning how to provide emotional care and support. Robert Pazon, or Paco for short, has been in and out of prison for 25 years. He spent more time behind bars than he has on the outside.
I guess I would be what you consider a mainstream convict. I've been violent here. I've done all the things that a convict does, and I have a good name.
When Paco says a good name, he means people are afraid of him. Paco's 42. He's a big Samoan guy with the build of a linebacker. And when he walks through the hallways of the prison, people move out of his way.
I grew up an angry young kid. Part of it was just being angry, not knowing, having a place and having no real specific direction. I did a 20-year sentence for robbery when I was 21 years old. I'm not trying to belittle the thing. I robbed two cab drivers at gunpoint down in Portland.
He was released back in 2005, but not for long. After another armed robbery charge, Paco's back in, and this time he's decided he wants to change. He's trying to put his reputation to use in a positive way. Now he's back in school, and he's almost completed his associate's degree.
I need to do something. I might get probably one more chance at a life outside of here.
The hospice program began in 2000 after Candace realized inmates were dying alone, with no one to care for them. The Maine State Prison Hospice Program is one of 68 in the country. It was modeled after the program at Angola in Louisiana, the largest maximum security prison in the U.S. Since starting hospice at Angola in 1998, violence decreased at the prison by 73%. Last year, Paco heard about the hospice volunteer program after visiting his friend Fred in the infirmary. Paco watched the hospice volunteers take care of Fred. They changed his sheets. They tucked him in at night. They sat with him during the early morning hours to keep him company. Paco wanted to help too, so he applied for the program.
when I got interviewed, they wanted me, and then security denied me, going back to, I do have a name here. And so, you know, and even when you change, not everyone else believes you change.
Paco was an unlikely candidate for the program because of his violent record. But he wanted to be in the program badly, and he fought for it hard. In the end, he was accepted. The men have different reasons for joining the program. Steve Carpentier was one of the first inmates to get involved in hospice. He's been in prison since 1989 for second-degree murder.
I used to run away from death.
KOP is now being held in the close unit. KOP is now being held in the close unit.
From when my father died, I ran away from it. I came in here, you couldn't run away from it because it was everywhere. It was really bad, the way the guys were being treated and the way they were dying.
I want to give to that program because I may one day need it myself.
That's Sam Basu. He's serving a 62-year sentence for murder.
And the harsh reality of it is that a lot of us are going to die in here. For me personally, I don't want to be alone. I don't think any of us do.
The 2 hours these inmates spend in the classroom every week is their opportunity to focus on the future, not what they've done. They spend their time making paper flowers for the prison memorial services, writing poems about their experiences with death, and learning to play music for the sick patients in the prison infirmary.
I've never met a man, woman, whatever, that is void of love. I've met a lot of people that don't have the skill set to show other people that. And having been a taker for the majority of my 40-something years, you know, it's, you know, being able to learn a different skill set on how to be a giver. That's what I get most out of this program.
Since Paco's joined, he stumbled upon his talent for singing, and he's become one of the lead singers in the hospice band.
I think the guys that I do it with that sing with me and they play the instruments, they make me sound better than what I am. She broke your throne, she cut your hair, and from your lips she drew the hallelujah. Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
One day last winter, Paco found one of his friends crying in the middle of the rec yard. The inmate had just received news that his mom had passed away. He was upset and alone. So Paco walked up to him and offered him help in the only way he knew how.
And I'm hugging him, I'm holding him while he's crying, you know, and nobody's looking at us weird, you know, they just, you know, they know. You know when something's really, really bad and really personal going on, there's that feeling in the air.
This is a big change for Paco. He isn't used to being the person people come to for hugs.
I mean, I was always that guy people came to for either protection or to do some type of muscle work, and now people come to me for insight and comfort, and so it's a different thing. And that's, again, that goes back to the prisoner trying to be more like the human being.
The prison has now graduated 2 classes of hospice volunteers. Candace Powell hopes to expand the hospice program to other prisons around the state. For Salt Radio, I'm Colleen Basu.
September 5th is always celebrated as Teachers' Day in India. That means no studies, some little song and dance programs in classrooms, and gifts of sweets for the teachers. Sandip Roy has fond memories of his old teacher and school prefect, Father Camille Boucher, who he says would not appreciate the current culture in many of today's schools.
September 5th is always Teachers' Day in India. That means no studies, little song and dance programs in classrooms, and gifts of sweets for teachers. My old teacher and school prefect, Father Camille Boucher, would have found little favor with today's parents. A pink-faced Jesuit priest from Luxembourg, he spoke English with a heavy Gallic accent. He smoked incessantly, stubbing out his cigarette as he walked into class, sometimes dropping ash down our collars. He used his cane liberally. If he was in charge now, someone would have surely been raising a stink about the chain-smoking, ash-scattering, cane-strumming foreign priest. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata. Father Boucher came to Kolkata in 1947, months after India's independence. At a time when for so many of his students, an education at a good school like ours was meant to be a ticket out of India, he made Kolkata his home. Today in India, teachers are measured by how well they prepare children for all the competitive examinations that lie ahead. Father Bushe was different, says my classmate Krishnendu Chaudhary.
I remember him saying, get a haircut. I remember him saying, gentlemen of good families and bad reputations. I remember him smacking us on the head. And I remember him giving us a lot of love, affection, and trust.
He showed us that the best teachers teach by just being.
He used to tell us stories about his days running away from the Germans during World War II. We all love to look at the scar in his leg where he took a bullet when he was some 13 or 14 years old.
The Germans shot 19 of his schoolmates and he went into hiding to avoid conscription. That was exciting stuff for us. There were other lessons not in our books. One in a letter he wrote that my mother has saved for over 30 years and repeats with great relish.
All what you are and have done shows the wonderful kind of parents you must have. I hope and pray that you may always remain true to them while fashioning your own destiny.
His job was to fashion us out of mud and bruised grass and send us out into the world. And if any of his old boys, perhaps a businessman now or a colonel, came back to visit, they would find him exactly where they left him, in his little room, his face shiny with sweat, in a worn singlet and trousers, his cassock hanging on a hook on the wall. Krishnendu remembers meeting him 10 years after school.
And I walked into his room, and his first reaction was, "Hello, Krishnendu. How are you? You went into medicine, didn't you? Is your mother still painting? Is your father still sailing or has he retired? What is your brother doing now? He was a bit of a handful, I seem to remember."
When he was diagnosed with cancer, we thought Father Bushe would leave Kolkata and go back to his native Luxembourg. He did, but he came back. It was simply the only home he had known. I was in America when he died in 2002. This year, I finally visited his grave. Looking at that simple slab in a quiet leafy garden, one among many other Jesuits buried there, I remembered him signing off that letter to me in a spidery scrawl. We do not expect to be remembered too long, but when it happens, it fills us with joy, he wrote. Your teacher, prefect, and above all, friend, I hope. I remember him correcting my first serious attempt at an English essay. Don't try to be too clever, he scolded me gently. Write simply. So in the end, I must just simply say, Happy Teacher's Day, Father Bushe, teacher, prefect, and above all, friend. And thank you. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
Still to come, the road to recovery from a traumatic brain injury is often long and sometimes closed forever. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1246. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Brain injuries have gotten a lot more attention from scientists and the public in recent years, due not only to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but in game accidents to athletes from the pros to Little League. Reporter Kelsey Padgett took notice for a different reason and learned what it's like to live with such a debilitating and long-term injury.
Last year, I woke up from a car crash, and I didn't know who I was. After a lost month, I returned to normal. But this got me interested in those who don't get back to their old life, their old selves. That's how I met Joel Fougere, a traumatic brain injury survivor who, after years of recovery, still suffers from his blow to the head. The moment that changed everything in his life happened on a normal Friday night in April of 2004.
And keep in mind, this is everything that I've been told. I have no recollection of this night whatsoever. I was a senior at the University of Maine in Orono, and a friend of mine and I were going to have a fun weekend out drinking. I have no idea what made me believe that he was capable of driving. The car that we hit was a Dodge Neon. And the passenger of the Dodge Neon died. The two vehicles hit front passenger corner to each. And I was tossed into the part of the frame that's in front of the door frame. Then the traumatic brain injury.
Before the wreck, Joel was your average young guy. Physically active, liked to have fun, didn't try that hard in school. But when he woke up...
I didn't know who my mother was.
He couldn't even identify everyday objects.
Joel, what's this? Holding up a spoon. And I would be like, I know what that is. It's plastic, it's little, it's round. And the therapist would keep saying, keep going, keep going. And I would say... You put food in your mouth with it, soup or ice cream or something like that, a spoon.
Recovery from a traumatic brain injury is a very slow process.
A brain injury, in my opinion, is like no other injury we have to our body. You
know? This is Dr. Austin Errico, a neuropsychologist.
Some people are in recovery for the remainder of their lives. The analogy is often used, if you take an intact egg and violently shake it and then open that egg, the yolk has been broken.
Joel's yolk was broken. His brain was bruised. And his doctors couldn't tell him when he'd be better or if he ever would be better.
It was like watching somebody be reborn.
This is Andrea. She was engaged to Joel when the accident happened.
I mean, he had to learn how to brush his teeth, comb his hair, dress himself, tie his shoes. Everything that we take for granted, he had to start over and do.
Even though he had to learn everything brand new, he made amazing strides.
I've had therapists and surgeons say that people like me just, they don't happen. I shouldn't be walking. I shouldn't be driving, especially.
I'm in the car with Joel, and he's driving me to his martial arts class.
Oh, come on, guy. Yeah, you are supposed to yield to me. And now I get all crushy because it's like, but why don't other people know how to drive?
During the recovery process, he took up Taekwondo. And even though it takes a lot out of him, he's dedicated. Amazingly, Joel became a black belt. And now he plans on staying at that level for the rest of his life.
It makes me... feel like there's hope that I'll be okay again someday.
It's hard for a relationship to survive a brain injury. Andrea and Joel had been engaged for less than a year when the wreck happened.
What's he going to be like when he wakes up? Is he going to be the same person? Is he going to be who we know? The first thing that he responded to was music, and he started mouthing the lyrics to the songs. When we saw that, I was like, we know he's still in there. We know he's still Joel, so that was a light of hope. There were family members that looked at me and said, you know, you didn't sign up for this, and no one's going to be mad at you if you walk away now. And I was like, what do you mean? I'm not going anywhere.
And she didn't. 4 years into the recovery, Joel and Andrea got married.
I thank God every day that she's still with me.
Joel's fortunate to have plenty of support with his recovery. He's actually in a survivor-led support group, which did a mock session at a traumatic brain injury conference at the University of Southern Maine. 7 people with similar injuries sat down and talked about what they're going through.
You said something that sparked a memory for me. I brought up at our last meeting about how I don't have children yet. I very much want to have children. I can't stay awake long enough to have children. Horrible to say.
Joel got a big laugh at this, but beyond the innuendo lies a bigger issue. One of the things he meant by not being able to stay awake is that he doesn't have the energy to work a full-time job that could possibly provide a stable income to raise children.
All of my time is either spent either getting ready for work or recovering for work. I'm in bed at 9:30 every night, and for like 2 or 3 hours before that, I'm either grumpy because I'm so damn tired, or I'm just tired.
That lack of energy is Joel's main symptom these days, and it's keeping him from reaching his big goals. So even though he's had this amazing recovery, he's still suffering. This may last for Joel for another 10 years, or even for the rest of his life, but he is still trying.
If I continue to work, then I could possibly be close to where I was. I want to just push myself as hard as I can now to do what I can. Whatever the hell that is, I want to be that. I want to be as good as I can be.
For Salt Radio, I'm Kelsey Padgett.
Rather than being made out of metal or plastic, there are some new medical devices that are smooth as silk. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Traditionally, metal plates and screws have been used in medical procedures. But as David Kaplan, professor and chair of Tufts University's Department of Biomedical Engineering, tells us, new natural advancements might provide a superior option.
When you fracture bones or have ligaments and tendons that need reattachment to bone, most surgical repair options today depend on using metallic screws and plates. In our recent research, we have developed all silk protein-based orthopedic devices such as screws and plates, and these are quite unique, avoiding the complications associated with metallic systems. Silk is already approved by the FDA for some medical devices, so orthopedic systems were the next logical step for this unique biomaterial. Unlike metallic systems, silk screws are 100% degradable in the body. This avoids having to remove the hardware with a second surgery once the fracture site is repaired. This is particularly relevant in children where bones are growing quickly. The silk devices are also radiolucent, so there is no interference from x-rays to track bone healing or during security screenings such as airports. In terms of mechanics, metallic systems tend to be rigid, and silk biomaterials are relatively rigid when dry to allow mechanical insertion into bone, but they soften upon hydration in the body to provide a better mechanical match to native bone tissue, and this avoids the complications that otherwise would arise. Silk systems also avoid the temperature sensitivity that can be a problem with metallic fixation. Silk is biocompatible, generating natural amino acids as it degrades. Another useful feature of silk screws is that they can be easily functionalized with antibiotics or other therapeutics to enhance repairs or to reduce infections at the surgical repair site. The future of silk-based medical devices is very exciting, and our team and our collaborators remain hard at work to study and develop this next generation of implantable devices based on silk.
That was David Kaplan of Tufts University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.